essentially you got another engine.
Mm-hmm.
And you get another propellant badge or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime you launch a solid, you're essentially launching a new engine.
Mm-hmm.
And this is my, you know, this is my own personal evaluation of it. I'm sure solid people could give you
an argument about no rotating machinery.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No cryogenics.
No purge.
That's right. Mm-hmm. It's strictly the people in command at the time, what they preferred.
Well, Von Braun was a liquid man.
Right.
Everything in Pheno Monday was liquid, right?
Yeah. But they finally gotten into some solids finally on the shuttle, or at least as the boosters in some ways.
But that wasn't Von Braun's idea.
Yeah. Wasn't there a barrier too? I've got it known here, about 260 ISP barrier on solids for a long time. That's about as good as they could get. You got into what, the J2 425, something like that?
Yeah, we get up to 426 nominal is mud spec.
Yeah.
We've gone up to 429. Yeah. So they can't compete ISP wise.
Yeah. So that'd be another reason. At least one of the design considerations.
Well, you don't take advantage of ISP until you get out of the gravitational range. You can still boost it to pretty high altitude.
Yeah.
With solid and then come in with a liquid.
So a liquid is much better not only at that altitude, yeah. Okay, I've got a question on the H1. Maybe you can help me, maybe not. Why was there a difference in the turbine exhaust disposal? Those outboard engines had a special thing around them.
Let's see if Jim's here.
Okay, excuse me. Actually, LH2 is a little more exotic. You know, you got a lot more combustion problems.
Yeah.
You got more handling problems. You got more of a disposal problem. But it sure does make it easier to cool the chamber. You know, like when they fire the J2, but when they fired the RL10, you know, the longer they fired it, the cooler the outside of the engine got. It just coated up with frost.
Yeah.
You can imagine 5,500 degrees inside this thing and frost on the outside, you know, that far away.
The ecologists like it. It's the exhaust products of pure water.
Yeah.
So
no problem, theoretically.
No problem.
Yeah.
And you ran into some interesting problems. Of course, when I first started working on the RL10, LH2 was a new state of the art, you know, as far as propellants. And a lot of funny things happened, and a lot of interesting occurrences. Of course, when they first started out, everybody was super cautious, you know.
Yeah.
And no matter how cautious you are, things still happen. And you find out that, oh, gee whiz, this thing's not quite as dangerous as we thought. So then you tend to relax a little bit, and then you get in a bad problem. They had a guy who was on one of the doers, on the portable doers, and they brought fuel in from New Jersey up to the start test facility. He was up on the carrier, and lightning struck the vent, set it on fire. And here he is straddling this 4,000 gallons of LH2, and damn thing's on fire. So,
yeah.
Well, you know, it didn't take him long to get off of there. But nothing happened.
It just, yeah.
Because the thing was, you know, venting.
Yeah.
Like a blowtorch.
And it was just, you know, a little plume of flame coming out, you know.
Yeah.
And the burning rate wasn't such that it, you know, went on down in there. So they just closed the vent, no problem.
Damped it down.
Yeah. But they did have a serious problem one time, probably while I was there. See, whenever they ran a turbo pump, all they did is run this fuel through, and they dumped it in the burn pit. So, you know, they weren't really getting anything out of it, because all they were doing was turning the pump and then burning it.
Yeah.
So they thought, golly, that sure is awfully wasteful. You know, maybe we could collect some of that LH2 and save it, you know. So they thought, well, we'll give it a try. And they put up a little test rig there, and had a great big tub, like, sitting on a scale. They were going to see how much they were going to catch. Well, it was a very humid, overcast, cloudy day. They're dumping this liquid hydrogen in this tank. And usually what happens whenever you have any vapors from liquid hydrogen, it immediately disperses and goes flying off into the sky, you know, because it's very light and spreads out. Well, this day it was so humid and overcast and everything. Instead of doing that, all these fumes just kind of flowed over this tank and along the ground. And it flowed under a door into a motor room with electrical motors.
Wow.
And they got a spark, and the whole damn thing ignited. And there was guys blown down the parking area and the asphalt aprons, and guys were rolling around like bowling balls. And one guy got burned quite badly. He was in the hospital for 2 or 3 months.
Was this on Centaur operations or was it on S4 operations? I don't remember.
It was just the RL-10 development program.
Yeah.
I don't know what application it was.
You know, the thing about the RL-10 that, as a layman, really kind of amazes me is the fact that they can get enough gas pressure just out of recirculation through the chamber to run the pump. Because on the J2, it took a gas generator starting that thing by pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And yet on the RL-10, they were able to get enough pressure just by running it through the regenerative tube.
Mm-hmm.
Why couldn't they use that for the J2?
I imagine the size of the turbine to turn is
okay. Yeah.
The mass that you've got to move.
And also, you got a restart problem in space. I suppose that would affect the.
You need a start tank for space.
Yeah. Okay. Well, actually, that kind of takes care of my question.
Well, you have a couple of H1s that weren't answered.
There's a guy I can still get a hold of to do those, I think. It's a guy named Dave Christensen. I don't know if you know him or not. He did a lot of early work on the S3D and H1. I'm sure he can.
DeWitt Westrop is the equivalent of Dick Rogers on this engine.
On the H1?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was going to call Cataldo then about
the raising.
Yeah.
I haven't answered your question on this. I think I have. I think it's a conglomerate of problems. So.
Well, look, and I'll just read this over, I think, then, for my own information. Interview with Mr. Ballou. I had a couple of questions. I don't mean to put a strain on your memory, but there's a couple of things I can't find readily. Back in the beginning of the RL-10, or the liquid hydrogen engine program, Pratt and Whitney was fooling around with the LR-119. Which is the second generation. And they finally wound up going back into the first generation LR-115 before they finally settled on the RL-10. I was wondering if you could remember why they gave up on the LR-119 and went back to the LR-115. Some sort of development problem in that, but I can't find any anything much more specific than that.
Let that thing run until it stops. These problems, Roger, where they couldn't get it to run full duration, it was shutting down.
Well, it could be. I really haven't, found it out.
This is when they were going to use 4 of them on the S4.
Well, they finally
we used 4.
And then they had to go back to the 6.
And then went back to 6. But that was with the RL-10, I think.
I don't know that those definitions. 115, 119, RL-10 are that significant. I don't recall that we sacrificed any, I would say, advancements in the development of an RL series engine when we dropped the 119 with the RL-10. As I recall, the RL-10 was taking all the knowledge from the 115,
mm-hmm.
plus the engineering studies and work on the advanced 19. And pulling those out and putting them into an RL-10 that had an application. RL-10 was built for a specific application, the Saturn family of launch vehicles. And I think when you have an application that can be defined and specified, you can get right to work and build a product and do a damn good job.
Mm-hmm.
But I recall it, we didn't have any concerns about the RL series per se, and we didn't have a direct application for what they call the RL-19 at the time, because what we had an application for was specific, and that was just redefined as RL-10. Of course, when we started the RL-10, it didn't have the compl- complete update as far as performance and all that that we finally wound up with as we flew it, and then as you now see it on the Centaur vehicle. So it did become improved even after we first began the development of the RF-10. So I don't believe that you'll find any major significance in that nomenclature.
Okay, that's basically answered
that. Because when you asked me, it didn't ring a bell at all. Why not the RL-19?
Well, this is in one of Aiken's chronologies. I really haven't found anything else. It was just a comment made in there, and I really can't find anything. Rod Stewart, we talked to him, he didn't remember anything about it either. And another thing, in one of the reports that you wrote, and I think it must have been a Stewart or somebody, made the comment that there was no use for the F-1 in 1959, and that this was not unusual, in developing engines. And I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit on that, about, the development of engines, and that they are sometimes begun before stages actually come into being, et cetera.
Well, the F-1 had its beginning as far as some work relative to technology of large rocket engines. That was, I guess, in 59, or early 59. And then, Sputnik went up.
Sputnik actually went up
57
in December.
Then this whole business of space began to take hold as a new endeavor for this country, and of course the Russians and other interests.
You were at ABMA then?
Yes. And there was a decision that, I guess it was a final decision that presidential level that in the Congress, I guess it was a congressional decision, that we as a country should develop a very large rocket engine. And that large rocket engine was defined as what became the F-1. And it was that kind of decision that brought the F-1 into being. Now that program was transferred from a whatever technology, basic phase AB, study type work, and some very slight hardware work, was transferred officially, I think that was in 60, to us, in that it was a Rocketdyne contracted for effort by, I guess that was the Air Force at the time. So we picked it up just a little before we became a part of the NASA organization, and picked it up as a rocket engine development program. And that was complemented by, there were studies, on large vehicles. And those studies bracketed the size of this engine. Size of this engine were complementary to the studies on launch vehicles that were being made. Was a Saturn launch vehicle, specified. And the logic of doing that has a lot of history in that it's known that the rocket engine development cycle is the longest lead item in the development of a launch vehicle, or in the development of an aircraft. You just take the engines that go into our airplanes. Those usually have some lead on the complete definition of an airplane. Usually you'll say, okay, I'll build an airplane based on having knowledge of an engine kind of development that's going on. That's often the case. So we didn't do this start the Saturn engine development out of pure ignorance as to what it took in the way of time and all. The other factor on I would say, desensitizing engine development in the dark relative to the launch vehicle is the fact that it became evident that engines could be clustered and used, you know, in numbers rather than a single engine for a single stage. So that sort of takes away from a sensitive sizing of an engine relative to a certain vehicle. Now there are certain limits on that, but the facts are that the F1 did become a clustered engine, and before we finally wound up with the Saturn V design and built it, we had several studies that had all kinds of numbers, you know, of course, clustering engines for certain lunar missions, depending on how you conduct the mission.
Was there some thought to just using the F1 on the Saturn 1 or 1B as a test bed?
Well, those considerations, of course, were made in arriving at final decisions. You go through almost all of the possibilities, and as you go through them, you begin to sort them out. Come down to a final kind of configuration. But when you do everything in series, like you first fly it as a single engine on a sort of a S1B type stage, before you put it into a cluster, you can add enough time that you can never get your final product down. And of course, that ties back to having enough experience out of the 50s, you know, out of the development of large vehicles for the military, DOD and all, and then out of some of the uses of those kinds of components for space work, that you begin to build the knowledge and confidence that says, okay, we take some bolder steps, like we go all up. You know, that was one of the contributions, I would say, that Dr. Miller had to the Apollo program. Take a bold step and go all up. You launch a Saturn V with everything on it, instead of launching the first stage with nothing above it except dummies, and then you finally get to the first and second with nothing but dummies above those, and so on up. You shove the whole thing together, launch it all at one time, at least up to the point of the payload.
Do you think it would have been impossible to have made the manned lunar landing within the decade? Had you not gone to all up, could you have made it by going, you know, in the building block approach at all?
Well, we were within a year, weren't we?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, that year isn't a lot of margin compared to when we began to, you know, almost 10 years earlier.
Yeah.
Would you say something about the initial opposition at MSFC to the all up concept when George Miller proposed it?
Well, I think opposition's probably not the,
or questioning,
not the right word. I would say that we had to go through a process of an iterative process, which consisted primarily of systems engineering in our own minds of what that really meant. And that does have a bearing on the kind of test program that is conducted on the ground, on your hardware. And with all those factors thrown together, where we did have a test program that then did give us the assurance, we committed to that kind of a system. Now, for someone to come off, you know, to come into the system and say, okay, we're going to go all up, that's one thing. But to say that and not allow a comprehensive test program that gives you the kind of background you need, that would be one thing compared to structuring a test program that allows you to do more on the ground before you go all up. I think that we went through the logical sequence of engineering analyses before we said, okay, we will commit. And that's just the way you run a program. I think to accept those kinds of, I would say, rather dramatic changes in approach without thinking and engineering your way through it would be a rather dangerous thing to do. Now, compared to the beginning and early 50s on large launch vehicles for DOD application. We accounted for a certain amount of our first launches as part of the development of a vehicle. We would expect that we would have some problems in the subsystems of a launch vehicle and maybe lose several flights in the series of developing that vehicle. Now that completely changed in this Apollo thing, which really said we've got to do better on the use of our experience, which we did, and we have to put together a doggone well thought through program that's systems engineered and then backed up with the right test.
Just because
to build that confidence. It's
Was that because it was so expensive or because it was manned or how?
Well, it's what you would want to do on anything not exclusively tied to launch vehicles or space stuff if you had the kind of background experience. It's just the logical thing to do with any kind of product. You want to do the most you can with the data. That's engineering on by analysis and by the use of our tools that we have. And then the testing of the systems on the ground and where the biggest cost is, try to minimize that effort. And the biggest cost in this would be building several of those just for proving the hardware by flight. So we minimize that effort by doing a whole lot more with the knowledge we have. It requires a much higher level of engineering talent, especially oriented towards systems engineering talent, when you take those kinds of steps. It was the right kind of thing to do, looking back, even though we had some reservations at the beginning.
Were there technologies that came about in the 60s that made that possible, like automatic checkout?
Well, I think the technologies were basically there. I think the better use of that capability contributed an awful lot to that, yes. Certainly the kind of checkout gear that one has and that we had at that time had a great deal to do with it, yes. When you run a checkout and everything is hard-lined and everything has to do with man being completely in every piece of data extracted, that begins to get rather undoable when you're talking about an Apollo-type vehicle. You know, the Saturn and then the Apollo spacecraft on top of it. You just have to exploit the automatic checkout capability. But at the beginning of the 60s, I think one would have to say the basic technology was all there. It just took a challenge like the Apollo-Saturn to put that to use. And when you commit to Apollo-Saturn in a decade, you doggone well have to put that to use. There's no choice. You don't make it if you don't. So I guess the answer is yes.
What about the engine programs? Can you say that liquid hydrogen caused you more problems than the Lockhart P1? Or do you have to make distinctions of the two different kinds of engines and systems involved?
Well, I would say if you go all the way back on engine development, at one time oxygen was called secret fuel, you know. You go that far, probably because it was less understood than other propellants like kerosene or alcohol. So it just has to do with one's understanding of what he's working with now. On liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, there's a combination which is the propellant in the RL-10 engine and also the K2 engine. At the beginning, there were concerns, yes, because the combination is very combustible, and when exposed to that, you know, the normal atmosphere, it does evaporate. You don't see it run like you do the rest of the kerosene stuff. So to the average common guy that works these systems, the technicians and all, they're less known about that combination. So I think that had a bit to do with it. The actual development of an engine has to consider lots of things, like the flow and cooling characteristics, combustibility, and susceptibility of these various propellants as far as rough combustion, you know, which was a very major part of the development on the engine the size of the F1. So all those were less known than the propellants we've been dealing with. And the propellants we were dealing with primarily at the time in our work were basically the kerosene and oxygen. And of course, we used alcohol and, say, the redstone stuff. And then the acids, of course, were used in many of the other systems, but none up until the RL-10 had really used the hydrogen oxygen. So it was just a matter of dealing with something less known by the fact that we hadn't had the time and the number of different systems exposed to it. But looking at the way it came out, I would say that from my personal experience, hydrogen oxygen is probably the best combination that we have in rocket engines today as far as the ease of developing a system that performs well, you know, as far as the normal things one fears. That's rough combustion and the cooling aspects of this type of hardware. And it does yield high performance. It gives a bit of problem to containing it because of the relatively lightweight, you get pretty large tanks, you know. That was certainly overcome very readily by the fact that something like the S2 stage was developed with very large tanks that were very successful. But basically, the hydrogen oxygen engines have been very reliable in comparison to what we termed or categorized as conventional propellants up to that point in time.
We were talking to Douglas engineers who went out to Los Angeles about a year and a half ago. And of course, it was Douglas, but they kept emphasizing that the S4, for example, was just an awful lot different than the Centaur. And one engineer commented that we had to fight to keep the S4 from just being another Centaur. Do you see that there are that much differences in the system, the Centaur and the S4?
Well, the engines are essentially the same.
Yeah.
In fact, we delivered engines to the two vehicles out of the same line at the time with some very slight modifications, but not much. The difference has to do with the system, the total system, tankage and all. Now, there are differences there.
Internal insulation and so on.
Well, I would say sensitivity to weight is more critical on a Centaur vehicle than it had on the S4. S4 was, in my own assessment, a more conservative approach.
Hmm.
Not so sensitive to weight as a Centaur. Yeah, so from a vehicle point of view, yes, they're quite different from the engine and what flows through it, basically. No difference.
Primarily the pressure stabilization of the Centaur as opposed to the fact that the S4 being just stand up there.
Well, the booster on the Centaur is pressure stabilized. Now, the Centaur stage is not pressure stabilized. I thought you were talking about the Centaur second stage that had the RL-10 in it. It has less conservative design because of its sensitivity to weight than the S4. The S4, we just built it kind of conservative, to be frank. You can, when you do that, you can come out with a test program that's more predictable, I would say more predictable, and hopefully